Hey, it's Dr. Jamie, and I want to personally thank the sponsor of today's Fit and Fabulous podcast, Nutola. Nutola was created out of a love for granola, but everything on the market was full of sugar. So the creator of Nutola got creative and made her own. The personal training client started eating it and encouraged her to actually start marketing it. So she did. Nutola is amazing because it only has 4 net carbs. It has perfect macros for a ketogenic diet, has 0 added sugar or sugar alcohols. It's available in monk fruit sweetened and in unsweetened. In the sweetened, there's 6 ingredients, and in the unsweetened, there's only 5 ingredients. You guys, you know I always give you the hookup. So use code DRFITANDFABULOUS, that's DRFITANDFABULOUS for 15% off at www.visionaryfoods.net. That's Dr. Fit and Fabulous for 15% off, www.visionaryfoods.net. Go check it out. Welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman. Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Jamie. Welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. I'm so excited that you're here and tuning in with us today. Hey, once again, the best way that you can help us out is every time you download the episodes, when you leave reviews, it really helps all those little algorithms out there to help us gain visibility so that more people can hear these messages and the topics that we discuss. So thank you to everybody that's doing that. And for those of you willing to do it, thank you. Thank you. I have an amazing guest. You guys might have seen a live I did with her recently in the last couple of days to weeks. But Victoria Field, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to see you again, and just appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, I can't wait to see you in person. But for those of you who don't know Victoria Field, she's originally from England. She's California raised. Victoria's professional life is eclectic as her roots are. The first 10 years of her career she included covering the news as an NBC affiliate TV anchor. She competed as a professional athlete, co-created several fitness businesses alongside her husband, Josh. Victoria's passion for health optimization and nutrition later led to her involvement in cancer research utilizing ketogenic metabolic therapy and co-founding the organization Metabolic Health Initiative. Metabolic Health Initiative is dedicated to providing cutting-edge evidence-based education to scientists, healthcare professionals, and the general public through digital content and live events, including the annual International Scientific Conference, Metabolic Health Summit. And that is where I first got to meet Victoria in person. And I'm so excited. We're going to talk about it. It's coming back this year in Santa Barbara. But MHS was organized by herself, as well as 2 other scientists, Dr. Dominic D'Agostino and Dr. Angela Poff. And they have brought together these progressive physicians, world-renowned scientists, thought leaders to research metabolic health and therapies and the powerful potential of our daily choices. That certainly resonates with me big time. The conference has the mission of revolutionizing science and medicine by refocusing attention on the importance of nutrition and metabolism in treating diseases, increasing the health span, and improving human performance. So if you guys are interested in learning more about Victoria's work and Metabolic Health Summit 2022, which will be in Santa Barbara, you guys go to metabolichealthsummit.com and check it out. Victoria, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited for our conversation today.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about your background and how you ever got, you know, MHS is of course this beautiful creation of your passion and Dr. D'Agostino and Dr. Poff, but tell us a little bit more about why that was an interest to you.
Yeah, it's kind of, as you mentioned, my background is, I feel like a cat that's kind of lived like 9 lives. it's been an interesting road, honestly. You know, my career kind of, I started in TV news right out of college as a writer and then went on to be a reporter and anchor, and actually had a big focus around health during that time, covered a lot of your like latest science-based stories. And from there, really started to develop that passion on the side and created several fitness businesses alongside my husband that, you know, allowed us to train athletes, take a deep dive into nutrition science, and just that further fueled my passion around it. Started to compete in the fitness and bodybuilding world, and it really took off. And we, but at a certain point, we kind of got to a place where, while it was so rewarding, we really started to develop an interest in that deeper meaning of metabolic health, and, you know, how sort of our, obviously, as you know, the fitness and bodybuilding world is an interesting space.
It's not all healthy.
No, it's not. And what was interesting was we actually developed our businesses based off of the approach of doing it in a more healthy way. So, you know, very natural way, good quality food sources, not severe, crazy calorie restriction, kind of how I practiced what I did as an athlete myself. We started to help other athletes through our certifications in nutrition and whatnot. And that is actually how we built our business, was around making, you know, fitness and bodybuilding sort of more healthier. And it was really kind of the start of wanting to explore something beyond just sort of the athlete, but really like how do we look at, you know, human performance, disease, and the power of nutrition in this place. And so at the time, actually, some good friends of ours were, who are the founders of Quest Nutrition, were very, very interested in cancer. And actually, they had an interesting discussion with, at the time, this was years ago, with Dr. Dominic D'Agostino and Dr. Peter Attia around the potential role of ketogenic metabolic therapy in cancer. And they said, well, how do we start actually looking at this and validating it with people, right? Because this is all great, but science takes time. So how do we get started and solve the big, super simple question of cancer, right? Which is very complex. And so that's where KetoPet was born, and Epigenix Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization involving studying ketogenic metabolic therapy. And I came on board to sort of lead that charge and sort of transitioned out of the fitness world. And a lot of what our research or what we did was based on was what Dominic D'Agostino and Dr. Angel Poff were doing in the lab. That was sort of our foundation and really the first meeting for us to kind of collaborate. And we actually ended up, so KetoPet is sort of just to give you a brief background on that, which we could have a whole podcast on. It's really interesting. It was a 53-acre ranch in Texas that we opened up to be able to rescue dogs with naturally occurring forms of cancer that were otherwise going to be euthanized, put them on a ketogenic diet. We had PET CT imaging on site, metabolic conditioning for these dogs, and sort of recorded every ounce of data you could possibly think of, weighed out all their food, much like a bodybuilding diet, and provided them with this ketogenic metabolic therapy and had incredible results from that. And from there, we developed partnerships with oncologists to be able to lead certain pilot studies around, you know, exploring this for people. And so I actually worked with a variety of cancer patients, a little over 100 different cancer patients with various forms of cancer, from early stage breast cancer to late stage brain cancer, in implementing ketogenic metabolic therapy. And that actually has led on to one of the oncologists, neuro-oncologist by the name of Dr. Jethro Hu, who has expanded his research into a clinical trial and has taken that and run with it. But back to Metabolic Health Summit, when I met Dr. Poff and Dr. D'Agostino during this process, it was really evident that there were scientists all over the world using metabolic therapy for everything from, you know, Alzheimer's to metabolic syndrome to athletic performance. But it was like everybody was working in a sort of like a silo. Nobody was talking to one another. We really saw it as an opportunity to, you know, how do we bring these minds together? Because really where the magic is in research is collaboration. And that was really the sort of birth of Metabolic Health Summit. At the time, it was called the Conference on Nutritional Ketosis and Metabolic Therapeutics, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it was very applicable at the time. And it was honestly just supposed to be a meeting and a scientific meeting of, you know, maybe under 50 people, and over 200 showed up. And it was really exciting to see that this was really something. We really, you know, we had scientists present their research on what was kind of happening in the space. And it was evident that we needed to expand it and also include the public in the conversation, because we actually had patients showing up, we had athletes showing up, we had people just wanting to get a really good understanding of the science on metabolic health. And I think this conversation, it has to be inclusive of the public, as well as the clinicians doing the work, you know, as well as the scientists in the trenches in the lab. We have to include the public in this. So we open it up to include everybody. And it's a really amazing split of two worlds. And our mission has really become, you know, bridging the gap between science and society. And yeah, I got out of the fitness world, and this has become all consuming. And our mission is to really, honestly, it's a big lofty goal, but revolutionize science and medicine by bringing nutrition into the conversation as it applies to disease prevention, to increasing health span, and to honestly optimizing human health as a whole. So yeah, that's kind of the mix up of my background, but it's exciting.
So where we're headed. Tell people who come to MHS, like, who are some of the speakers that they're hearing from? And like, I just want people to understand like the breadth and broadness of these different topics that metabolic therapy is used for.
Yeah. So it's really a wide range of speakers that we have. It's really cutting edge. Well, one, Dr. Jamie Seaman will be speaking and covering metabolic health for women specifically, and optimization. And actually, Dr. Seaman, you were with us last year, and it was an incredible turnout for your talk specifically. I think we need to talk more about women's health on many levels. But we do have a variety of other physicians. We're doing some really interesting research from, you know, Dr. Dale Bredesen, who's on the forefront of Alzheimer's research, and honestly has put out some really interesting books on reversing cognitive decline, which is completely unheard of in this day and age. And so, you know, he'll be presenting on Alzheimer's. So in our neuro symposium, we have metabolic psychiatrists discussing how they've been able to implement metabolic-based therapies alongside standard of care for schizophrenic patients. And in some cases, shockingly, have even been able to help them wean off certain medications. You know, we cover topics on, you know, metabolic syndrome, on human optimization. We have scientists in the trenches looking into brain cancer. So it's such a vast amount of topics. And in addition, also on the implementation side too, because I think that's really important. So we have a few different dietitians, who, one of which is an oncology specialist, so talking about ketogenic metabolic therapy for cancer. We have gut microbiome scientist that's coming out, sleep, you name it. We really cover all topics that are inclusive of metabolic health. But the reason we called the conference Metabolic Health Summit is we're going to go where the science takes us, which, you know, is right now is showing that the ketogenic diet, low carb living is really, you know, showing a whole lot of promise and has done for a long time, about 100 years now in epilepsy. But we're going to go where the science takes us. It's an exciting conference that covers a vast amount of topics from science all the way to application. But the speakers that we have come out really are able to provide this information in a way that's super interesting and exciting for the physician, but also understandable for the everyday person that wants to get this information too.
Yeah, it was incredible coming out last year because I'm like, this is the coolest conference I've ever been to, because most conferences are really stuffy. Right. They're long and exhausting. You have basic scientists talking in a way that clinical doctors are like, oh my gosh, like, you know, this is over my head. So I think you've done such a fantastic job of kind of melting those two worlds together. And I know people that came that were just normal everyday people. They don't work in healthcare, all the way to people who are, you know, published up and down in their area of expertise. For cancer, because that's kind of the area you came from, is there particular cancers that seem promising as far as metabolic therapies?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think it's a really exciting, much like sort of the neurological space, it's a really exciting area of research and showing a lot of promise just based on just, you know, what we know about cancer metabolism alone. And I think there's a lot of work to be done around precision nutrition for cancer specifically. And there's some really great work actually out of the Lewis Cantley lab with Dr. Marcus Goncalves, who came out, I think, last year. Maybe you got a chance to meet him, and some of the work they're doing with precision nutrition and cancer. And just looking at, because cancer is such a complex disease and everybody is so different. And I really worked with patients from, you know, really early stage breast cancer all the way to rare forms of cancer like synovial sarcomas and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And so I think it's very vast, but there's some promising research, I will say, specifically around brain cancer, much like some of the, I guess, ways that it works within epilepsy, just in terms of ketones themselves being sort of neuroprotective and you know, inflammation in the brain and a variety of other things. I would say the most exciting area and group that we worked with in terms of what we saw with glioblastoma patients, which if you know anything about glioblastoma, the prognosis is really grim. You're looking at maybe a couple of years upon diagnosis. And this is like a shocking, like you one day are normal, the next day you have a seizure, you're in, you know, the emergency room, they run a brain scan, you have a massive tumor, like GBM, and you're dealing with, you know, just this whole complete life shift, and you're facing, you know, mortality in the face. And anyway, it was one cancer that honestly, standard of care, while important, unfortunately isn't providing much of an extension of life. And it certainly isn't really improving quality of life, right? So we implemented these therapies specifically, and this is actually Dr. Jethro Hu and LJ Amaral, who's an oncology dietitian out of Cedars-Sinai, have taken this and ran with it since and are showing some really exciting stuff that they'll go into detail at the conference. But, you know, you were seeing some people who, I worked with some people who lost their ability to read and regain their ability to read on the ketogenic diet, who, you know, literally didn't really have much function. And I think there's something to both what it might do and for the brain itself, and just in terms of like, you know, reducing tumor size and things like that. But even more so, I think the diet for these patients who are dealing with such a difficult prognosis, it gave them something they could do that they felt like they were a part of the treatment program, which was so empowering. And I think that in and of itself provided a really necessary boost in overall ability to be able to kind of move forward in this. So I would say brain cancer is probably one of those most specific and interesting things, because, you know, with brain cancer, epilepsy, you know, seizures can come along with that. And we all know that, you know, the ketogenic diet can be hugely effective within the epilepsy space, you know, where drugs fail often, the diet is implemented and stops seizures within, you know, 24 to 48 hours for some people. So I would say from my perspective, that area is really exciting, but there certainly is a lot of research involving precision nutrition for cancer that I think in the next, you know, five to 10 years, it's going to be a bigger part of the conversation upon diagnosis for people.
Yeah. Can you just, for our listeners' sake, you know, I think a lot of people think low carb ketogenic diets, they're all the same thing. For these people, when you say like precision nutrition, when you're talking about like therapeutic ketosis, like are these people being monitored for certain levels of ketones? Like what levels are we talking about as far as, you know, metabolic therapy per se?
Yeah, it's a totally different ballgame where obviously you're talking about therapeutic ketosis. I mean, with epilepsy, you're looking at like a 4-to-1 ratio ketogenic diet where, you know, 90%+ of your calories are coming from fat, right? There's a wide range. Most of the patients that we were working with were on about a 2-to-1 ratio. And so it varies. I think a good goal and a good marker is the sort of the GKI or the glucose ketone index that was developed by Dr. Thomas Seyfried, who's a really world-renowned researcher within the cancer metabolic therapy space. And that really is a great indicator of kind of where things are at, because, you know, you really, it's interesting because some of these patients are dealing with much more than just cancer, right? So you're looking at things like insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome, all kinds of other ailments that can kind of totally shift glucose numbers and ketones. So we really aimed for as high as we could get with some people for ketones. Granted, there's a lot more that we need to learn about what it means to have higher circulating ketones, you know, versus lower, and ketone utilization. And there's a lot there, and it's a lot to unpack. But we would look for high ketone levels, and honestly, getting blood glucose under, I would say, 70 if we can on a consistent basis. But again, some of these people are dealing with immense amount of stress. And as you know, stress in and of itself can just completely throw off your glucose levels and a variety of other things. So it's really challenging. I mean, I think one of the biggest barriers has been, you know, being able to help people and sticking with this kind of a diet, right, in a way that helps them, is sort of sustainable at the same time. So I think that's the biggest challenge, is like, you want it to be therapeutic. Sustainability is also important. So at least for what we did in the studies that we were working on, we really try to combine those two factors, because I think, you know, a therapeutic ketogenic diet is only as great as the length of time you can stay on it. Yeah. So it's a different ballgame than, of course, a regular like ketogenic diet, that much like what you do, where you like will cycle in and out of ketosis, which I think could be very, very healthy for, you know, somebody who's got good metabolic health, you know, compared to somebody who's in the throes of a cancer diagnosis. It's a totally different ballgame. It's calorically restricted. Fasting sometimes is involved. But I also think too, I was able to take my fitness and nutrition background and make it as fun as possible when working with cancer patients, because I think that's important. So yeah.
Yeah, I've definitely followed the research in my areas, which is like, you know, breast, uterine, ovarian, both have really good data to suggest that ketogenic therapies can be super helpful as an adjunct. And then, yeah, fasting prior to chemo radiation seems to sensitize cells, you know, for destruction. So
just, yeah, Dr. Adrian Scheck's work is so interesting, just in terms of like the potential there on maybe improving the efficacy of some of these treatments. And also, you know, ketogenic metabolic therapy or fasting, just being sort of a way to potentially, you know, lower the dose of some of these things because of that sensitization that you were talking about. So that's so interesting, because I think, you know, if from my perspective, it's like, yeah, we've got to do the science to make sure that we know that the direction we're headed is legitimate and evidence-based and all the things. But we're also talking about nutrition, and we're talking about, you know, or not nutrition, not eating, right? And these are very simple things that, you know, obviously we've got incredible standard of care, but I just feel like with food, it doesn't hurt to make that a part of the conversation, especially if there's potential, like what we're talking about with improving already, you know, standardized care.
Yeah. And, you know, decreasing side effects of some things too. Sometimes the cure is worse than the, you know, the treatment's worse than the disease,
right?
For some of these therapies. So such an important area that people are exploring there, and I'm super excited about it. Okay. So when I last saw Victoria at MHS, well, first of all, before we move on from this, tell people, what are the dates again for MHS this year, and how do they find tickets?
Yeah. So the dates are May 5th through May 8th in Santa Barbara, California, at the Santa Barbara Hilton Beachfront Resort, which I'm so sorry, it has to be right across the street from the beach. I think I said that to you.
For sure. Okay.
It's a real big bummer that it's in this beautiful location. Yeah, no, it's going to be amazing. And for your listeners, if they would like 20% off, use the code SEMEN on our website, metabolichealthsummit.com, SEMEN spelled as in Dr. Seaman's last name, on our website. And you can find our speakers there. We also have an amazing expo that includes a variety of, you know, food, technology, optimization-based brands that are really making this lifestyle and overall, you know, human optimization a reality, I think, for society. And it's a very unique experience. You'll have a chance to meet Dr. Seaman and a variety of other incredible people. And excited to kick it off with you. And excited you're going to be here for the whole weekend this time.
Yes. Last year, we were talking about this on the live that we did, is I was filming Titan Games and nobody knew where I was or what I was doing. I wasn't allowed. I'd signed all these non-disclosures with NBC.
whispered in the corner to me what was happening. I was like, oh, that's so cool.
And I had to beg them to let me fly from filming. We were filming in Atlanta. So Titan Games was filmed at this sound studio where The Rock films a lot of his things down in Union City, Georgia. And so I said, I've got this obligation. I've got to speak. I've signed a contract. I must fulfill it. And I knew with the filming schedule that it was going to be like a possibility. And so I said, you have to let me fly. Like, I'll fly a red eye. I'll do whatever it takes to make this happen. And so they said, okay, you have 24 hours. So you have 24 hours to go to whatever this thing is you're doing and come back. So I'm like in the midst of filming. And then I get on this 4 a.m. flight in Atlanta. So luckily I'm flying Atlanta to California. So, you know, had the advantage there of the time. And then I land at 7 o'clock in the morning and Uber over to the hotel. And it was like, I was just like right into the whirlwind. I mean, these things are so much fun because you get to see and connect with people that you've seen online, but you don't get to see in person. Had the most amazing day at MHS. I spoke full room, standing room only. And we had a mixer that night. And I was like, well, I guess I'll have like one glass of wine before I go get on my red eye flight. And Victoria and I got to connect. Little did we know what was about to happen in the world. And yeah, it's surreal. It's like surreal now thinking about it, because it was like the last weekend of January. And I remember when we were at Titan Games, we were joking about these cruise ships that had COVID, and we're like, oh, I heard tickets to Wuhan are cheap right now. And so I fly back and I finish Titan Games, but yeah, I like whispered to a few people. I was like, you have no idea what I'm doing right now, but I gotta go.
Amazing. I know, you're like, I was like, wait, what are you doing? That's really cool. And we were just thankful to have you there for the day. It was really great. At least you got to see, I think, the synchro swimmers and at the VIP that night, which was kind of fun. We try to do some really crazy experiences. I don't think the previous year, we actually had Josh Perry, who I know you probably are familiar
with. I've heard the story about this, but I didn't get to see it. Yeah.
So we really try to create like this full circle experience for people where you get like the cutting edge science, but then you get to experience the impact of this in real life. And Josh Perry, who's a pro BMX athlete, former pro BMX athlete, who has suffered from several brain tumors, went through standard of care, found ketogenic metabolic therapy and implemented that and has just transformed. And now is a motivational speaker. He's doing all kinds of stuff. And he actually was able to get back on his bike. And so he said, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if he could perform? And so he built this like 65-foot ramp inside the ballroom at our gala dinner so he could show the power of this therapy and just nutrition in general. And it was really incredible experience. But I'm so glad though you at least got to see some of the fun, unique things that we do at the event. And who knew the world was going to go sideways after that? It was funny. We have a lot of obviously scientists that come out that were like, you should really like think about like, is anybody coming in from, you know, from China and what's kind of going on? And we're like, we're not really worried. And then it was like, you know, the whole world changed and we're like, okay, so we're excited to come back together because it's been, you know, 2021, we weren't able to do it. And so it's going to be, I think people are excited, ready to kind of come together and move this whole thing forward.
And now a quick word from our sponsor, That's It. That's It makes delicious, convenient super snacks from only the purest ingredients. If you're looking for a quick snack for yourself or your kiddos that's all natural, non-GMO, and preservative-free, you have got to try these products. In my house, we love the apple and mango flavor, but really, they're all delicious. These snacks are school safe, and they're completely free from the top 12 allergens. They're so perfect for busy families with simple, recognizable ingredients in portable, convenient formats. You can find That's It products nationwide at your Starbucks, at major retailers such as Target, Walmart, Whole Foods, and Costco. You can even find them online at Amazon and at thatsitfruit.com. If you head over to thatsitfruit.com/DrFit, and you use my code DrFit, that's DrFit, you'll get 20% off your first order. Go ahead and check it out.
Yeah, I'm excited. So later that year, as the pandemic is unfolding, I mean, working in medicine, it was strange times. And it still honestly is. Here we are 2 years later. You couldn't have paid me to believe we'd still be kind of in the midst of all this. But I remember finding out that Victoria had been diagnosed with COVID. And, you know, one of the messages that I've really been loud about, and I continue to be, despite the conversation we're about to have, is that metabolic health is a big deal, you know, especially in the midst of this pandemic, because we know across the board that most of the people with severe disease, hospitalization, and death have many underlying comorbidities. But Victoria was one of the first people that was very healthy. You know, obviously you discussed your background. I mean, there's always those people where you're like, well, is he healthy or did he not go to the doctor?
Right. Exactly. It's hard to tell. I'm like, I'm happy to provide anybody with my ridiculous bank of blood work to show you sort of how healthy we're talking here.
Yeah. But I want you to share your experience with people. And for those listening, this is in no way, shape or form, like political, we're not talking about all that stuff. We're just literally talking about Victoria's experience because it was eye-opening for me to watch her go through it.
Yeah. I mean, I could start with sort of the infection itself. You know, honestly, I wasn't really too worried initially, kind of like many others, I think, in the space where, you know, you work day in, day out to optimize your health in every way possible. And yeah, I was like, okay, this is a scary virus, maybe. But at the time, you know, we didn't really know anything about it, right? And that's why I think it was scary at the time. But I was like, you know, I have this foundation of great health. And obviously we know that I think, you know, people who are suffering from things like diabetes or metabolic syndrome or obesity or whatever are at much higher risk. So you kind of go into it with that perspective and it blindsided me and has completely shifted my perspective, of course, on everything. I mean, to go from, you know, 4 years, as long as I can remember practicing what I preach and just making sure every step of the way that my blood work was optimal, that I was in a really good place from, you know, the food that I put in my body and the quality of that to my gut microbiome, what does that look like, to sleep hygiene, every aspect. I really, really practice what I preach, to going from that to now, unfortunately, I've been dealing with a chronic COVID or long COVID for the last 14 months plus at this point. And it's gotten better over time, and we can kind of get into that if you'd like. But the infection itself actually kind of knocked me on my butt. I initially, when we first got infected, my husband and I sort of had this cough, little tickle in my throat, and a low grade fever. And I was like, okay. And then by day three, I was in excruciating pain. And it was like, I call it COVID bones. It was like deep in my hip joints, in through my lower backs, certain areas actually that I've had previous injuries in my fitness career. Everything lit up to the point where I actually thought maybe I have like a UTI or a kidney infection or something. Like, this is not normal, you know, viral pain. And so this was actually right before Thanksgiving. Went to the emergency room on Thanksgiving, which is the worst decision ever. Was the worst decision. It was like terrible. And at this point, this was like all time high, at least where I'm at. And unfortunately, the hospital that I went into, I was in this like hallway lined with COVID patients, kind of sitting on the floor waiting for rooms. It was kind of a nightmare. Finally got a room, and you know, they ran a bunch of tests, and I'm like, there's nothing we can really do for you. This is COVID. And unless you have breathing problems, you know, we can just give you maybe some painkillers and send you on your way. And I think it was like, this lasted for about maybe 9 days or so. And then I think it was about day eight or nine, I started to develop breathing issues. And this is where it became kind of really scary, actually, not kind of scary. My O2 saturation started to drop into the low 90s, sometimes kind of flirted with high 80s, which, you know, isn't great. I started to feel this searing chest pain in the center of my chest. I felt like I couldn't take a deep breath without this intense pain in my chest. Got so bad to the point where I had to kind of lay prone to feel like I could kind of breathe. And this lasted for about 3 days. Probably should have gone back to the hospital, to be honest with you, but from my Thanksgiving experience, I was like, I need to just tough this out at home. And honestly, I was afraid to go to sleep at night for about 3 days because I was worried. It felt like I was kind of suffocating, and I had a cough, and I had, you know, fever, and I had loss of sense of, you know, smell, taste, the whole thing. And so I started to, I think by like maybe 2 weeks in, the breathing issues started to subside, thankfully, at least in the form of like, felt like I couldn't like take even like a half a breath. It was like a quarter of a breath to get air in. That started to improve. But my voice was really weird. I was super short of breath, super tired, still having fevers. And to this day, I have a slew of symptoms that kind of pop up in sort of these flare-ups. It never really fully went away. I'm much better, obviously, than like in the thick of the infection. But I still have everything from shortness of breath. I have very reactive lungs. Like if there's anything in the air, like we'll grill outside because if we turn on the oven in the house, it sort of makes me feel that sensation of like, I can't take a full breath. I have fevers. So low-grade fevers sporadically that pop up. I get rashes out of nowhere. So almost like a lupus, like mylar rash across my face. I have brain fog. So I actually have like some notes here because trying to remember certain things, even things that I've experienced, can become kind of challenging. I've honestly like sort of written down a journal of everything since. I have chest pain just about every day that kind of feels like it's right in my heart. I have difficulty with altitude. There's like a slew of things really. I've not been able to get back to exercise. I can walk, which I'm so thankful for. But like my weight training and, you know, high intensity interval training, that's not been something that I can really do. And so, you know, of course, I've started to dive down the rabbit hole of having something that really has no, up until recently, like clinical case definition that we, you know, can kind of put a diagnostic criteria around. I mean, this is like kind of been the wild, wild west. And eye-opening to me in many ways, because I think there's a lot of other conditions out there similar to this that don't have answers. And it's a really scary place to be, especially, you know, I'm just thankful that I did have the foundation of metabolic health that I did going in, because I can't imagine if I hadn't had this.
You'd probably be dead.
Probably, honestly, I would probably, yeah, I probably would have been hospitalized. And it might not have been a good outcome. So I am very, very thankful for that. And I don't want to share this by, you know, to scare anybody or anything. I know everybody's sick of talking about COVID at this point, but I think it's important to get this other perspective and share my truth, which is why I started to become very honest with what I was experiencing. Even though I'll tell you what, like running and a scientific conference and the organization that, you know, I have is, it was very difficult to share this information, because I think it's been this process of like, you know, being in this, all of our colleagues and whatnot, sort of, you know, there's a lot of this sort of mentality around, if you have your health, you're going to be okay. And for me, I was this weird, this, you know, and it's not just for me, it's honestly, it's 30%+. I think some researchers are saying of people who suffer from a COVID-19 infection, at least from what we know with like Alpha, Delta, you know, all of that, Omicron, maybe new.
Right. I was going to say, you had one of the early variants, and I think
probably maybe Alpha. I don't know at this point. I didn't obviously like, you know, do the testing you'd need for that, but but we know that at least, I think the number is, I mean, it goes up to 40%, 60% in some estimations, but we know that people who get the COVID-19 infection will be dealing with some sort of long-term symptoms from that initial infection. And it's interesting, like I think the World Health Organization determines that if after 3 months you have continued symptoms for at least 2 months, then you have long COVID, but the CDC has a different definition. So we still don't have like clarity on
what is the
definition of it and how do we diagnose it. So that has been a very big challenge to figure it out, kind of alongside a few physicians who have really stepped up to the plate, but along the process, it's been difficult.
Yeah. What have these doctors told you? I mean, I know there's been some special clinics that have been set up for long haul COVID patients. And
yeah, so it's interesting. I've had everything. I mean, the testing I've had done is kind of ridiculous. Yeah, in terms of how many different tests I've had done is kind of ridiculous. But pulmonary, you know, from pulmonary CT to cardiac, you know, stress MRI to stress test to pulmonary function tests. So I've had, you know, my stress test and EKG come back abnormal, as well as my pulmonary function test came back where my gas exchange was much less than what we thought it would be. I mean, it was right around, I think, 70% or in the 70s. So That could explain the breathlessness that I experience on a pretty consistent basis. But most recently, I actually had some really interesting blood work that was sort of this like deep analysis of cytokines and inflammatory cytokines and immune markers that really came back showing many of them were highly activated. And this is like 14 months from initial infection. And by the way, this is pre-second infection, which I had over Christmas. Yay! Thankfully, Omicron, which is what we think or assume I had, was much more mild than the first rodeo. But yeah, I had this blood work done right before that happened. And that came back with a variety of elevated markers that show that I'm potentially dealing with high levels of vascular inflammation. So what's interesting is I've had your traditional inflammatory markers done. So everything from, you know, C-reactive protein to D-dimer, to you name it, I've had the blood work done. But until we kind of took a deeper look into my overall immune function and some of these cytokines, I've really had the blood work come back looking great. And my doctors were like, you're great. And I'm like, I'm not great. This is like super debilitating. So, you know, it's been interesting. I've kind of had to plan my whole life around it. And really, at this point, sort of the next steps, I've done a variety of lifestyle sort of interventions, if you will, and I'm happy to go into that. But
yeah, we'd love to hear about that, just because if there's somebody listening, you know, what have you tried? What have you found?
Yeah, it's been
modestly helpful.
Yeah. I don't know if it'd be helpful to maybe go into some of the theories around what might be causing it, sort of where the research is headed.
Yeah.
But I can kind of briefly touch on some of the lifestyle stuff I've done first. So you know, prior to getting infected, I was on a ketogenic diet, low carb diet, you know, really high quality, ketogenic diet. So everything down to, you know, your organic grass fed, the whole bit. But since dealing with long COVID, and we can get into this theory specifically, there's a theory around mast cell activation syndrome, which is something that's not super, it's very much kind of in its infancy in terms of research. So it's not sort of this widely, I think, accepted concept, but there's a lot of really interesting research going on around that. And I've gone on to a sort of a ketogenic antihistamine, anti-inflammation diet. It's been pretty intensive. My sleep hygiene, I've stepped it up to a whole new level. Meditation has been key, honestly, from a just overall just stress reduction of having these feeling completely, going from feeling completely in control of your body to feeling completely out of control of your body has definitely taken its toll. So meditation has been key. Breath work has been really, really helpful for me in expanding, you know, my lung capacity and just really kind of trying to heal my lungs and improve gas exchange and things like that. I think it's helped quite a bit on that front. I've done red light therapy, cold therapy. Cold therapy, honestly, was a little bit too intense and has actually triggered some flare-ups for me. So I think there's this like balance of, you know, this hormesis or hormetic balance.
Little.
Right. Little doses. And honestly, pacing is a big thing for long COVID sufferers. But what's so challenging is, you know, if you're kind of, I'm a very, very like, you know, type A, like go kind of person. So it's been really humbling to kind of figure out what pacing looks like for me, because I've never really had to do that in my life. And I'm always like, you know, on it. But yeah, I would say walking and not getting discouraged around, you know, not being able to get back to the normal exercise that I have. And then honestly, one of the most helpful things for me, and actually I went through a really bad flare up from October until December. I developed a new cough and some significant breathing issues for about 8-9 weeks, and fevers, you know, almost every week, random rashes were popping up. When I go into these flare-ups, it becomes sort of all these things start popping up out of nowhere with extreme fatigue. And during this time period, I was trying everything. I was trying every lifestyle hack under the sun, and nothing was working until I was like, you know what? I'm just going to cut out the food for, you know, I usually participate in, you know, time restricted eating on a pretty consistent basis. But in this instance, I did a 48-hour fast, and I found my cough started to improve a little bit. I was like, okay, maybe I should try this again. And so I did another, you know, typically I wouldn't recommend doing back to back to back prolonged fast, but for me, I was kind of in this like, okay, I got to do something.
Right.
So I did another one and things started to improve again. And finally, after about the third or fourth prolonged fast, I was able to get out of that flare up. So fasting has been really, really interesting. And honestly, I've actually found a really great doctor to work with me on this specifically, because I'm going to continue to do and implement prolonged fasts, I think, you know, at least once a week, and retest some of these cytokine markers and see if we've made any sort of difference. Because there's a lot of really encouraging research around, you know, Dr. Walter Longo's work around just the effect of fasting on immune function as a whole and immune dysregulation and potential there. Granted, a lot of it has been done in rodents, but it's really encouraging in terms of, you know, potentially kind of resetting the immune system in ways. And so that's something that's been really, really helpful is fasting, believe it or not. But there's about five or six theories that I think I've kind of dived down as I've ventured along this rabbit hole that I'd be happy to share. Granted, I want to say I'm not an immunologist. I'm not an expert in, you know, virology. This is something I've had to research and I've had to start to understand just in my own experience, but happy to share more on some of those theories that might make a little bit more sense around why I've tried what I have.
Yeah. So when I sent Victoria our pre-show notes, I told her I always have to tell people I do the semen analysis portion at the end. Otherwise people are like, you do what? Right. And so as time would have it, literally like in the last week, two articles came out that were very pertinent to the conversation that we're having now. And so like Victoria had kind of mentioned, so for long COVID sufferers, fatigue, breathing difficulties, and these other debilitating symptoms can persist for weeks or months. And I've personally had some patients, taste and smell has been an issue for a long time. Some dealing with headaches or hypertensive disorders, even within my own clinic, but in one estimate, up to 60% of people who have had COVID-19 still have symptoms 6 months later. The condition can arise from mild cases of any respiratory disease, but it's such a mystery, really. Up until now, we're finally seeing published papers kind of giving it a name. So there's two new studies that were published. One was in Cell. It was published on January 24th, just very recently. It looked at 200 patients over 2 to 3 months following their COVID diagnoses. The researchers determined that there was four biological factors that they thought were associated with whether a person would develop long COVID or not. And the factors could point us in a direction of, you know, being able to treat it. But they're now calling this PASC, which stands for post-acute sequelae of COVID. And the first factor that they looked at is the level of RNA in the blood at the time of diagnosis. And the authors say that that correlates basically with infection severity. We always kind of heard this buzzword of like cytokine storm, but now they're saying, you know, the presence of this RNA. The second one was the presence of autoantibodies, which I think is what Victoria would love to dive into. And these basically are antibodies that get created during the infection against your own tissues. And we know from other, you know, like type 1 diabetes, we know, you know, why do children develop it? Well, a lot of people think it's maybe after viral infection or after, I mean, we know from history that these things can and do happen. The third one was reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus, which can be common. That's mononucleosis, for those of you that don't know what that is. And some people deal with chronic EBV infections, which for the moment, nobody usually dies of Epstein-Barr virus, but it can be something that can be, you know, relatively harmless to some people and can really be a huge issue for others. And then the last one was type 2 diabetes. And I don't think that's any mystery to anybody. Like I said, I think Victoria, you probably would have been much more ill had you not been in such a good, you know, metabolic state. And then because I said there was two studies, the other one was published in Nature Communications. And they found that there was this antibody signature associated with long-term COVID-19. The study had blood samples from 175 people with SARS-CoV-2 and then 40 healthy controls The researchers looked at the blood antibody levels during the infection, and then they followed 134 of the participants for up to a year afterward, collecting additional blood samples at 6 and 12 months, and then documenting the symptoms that these patients have. So I would love to hear your thoughts on these two studies, because you have gone down more rabbit holes than any of us have, because it's, you know, a personal issue for you.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting. It's really exciting and interesting research, because I think there are a lot of obviously unanswered questions around long COVID, but there are a lot of unanswered questions around other autoimmune kind of conditions, like, you know, post-acute Lyme syndrome or lupus or what have you, that I think it's been interesting to kind of see long COVID bring these other topics to the forefront, where many of these patients probably felt somewhat forgotten, right? So I think that's really interesting. What's interesting as well is, I think in that same paper, the researchers discuss how they have discovered that obviously, you know, even mild cases, not even just severe cases, can obviously lead to something like long COVID. My case felt a little bit more on the, you know, moderate to severe side. Granted, I was not hospitalized, very thankful for that. But I think this has been found to even affect people that are asymptomatic, which is really, really interesting. So yeah, I think it's a step in the right direction. And I think it would be really helpful to know, and studies like this are really important, because they allow for us to potentially develop therapeutics when we know, or even just when we know ahead of time, if somebody's at increased risk for developing long COVID, does it make sense for somebody like that to implement certain autoimmune protocols or antihistamines or whatever the case may be? What's really interesting is actually there's a lot of research around H2 antagonists, famotidine specifically right now, just because of the sort of the histamine response that the virus can kind of trigger. But ultimately with that research, I think what's exciting is if we can know who's at higher risk, because I think it's really complex. It's not as simple as like, oh, you're in good metabolic health, great, you should be fine. Like, it's really interesting who's developing long COVID, many of which are healthy and truly healthy, not just like this person's healthy and, you know, they actually secretly eat, you know, I don't know, garbage. But so I think this is a step in the right direction. It touches on a lot of really important theories out there that I think need more development. So some of the top theories that I've kind of dived down, one of which is the whole autoimmunity, autoantibody theory, where essentially the virus can kind of trigger this response where your body, where it sort of attacks your own healthy cells as if they were invaders. It's a really awful, nasty kind of condition. And I think some researchers are actually finding autoantibodies in association with long COVID. There's also the theory around, like I kind of briefly mentioned, mast cell activation syndrome. This has yet to be really studied, but mast cells are really a critical part of our immune system that are usually known for things like asthma and anaphylaxis. They play that role there, but they also play a role in like a protective role for things like wound healing and defense against pathogens. And what they're thinking with this sort of mast cell activation syndrome is that when the virus sort of infects you, for some people, it can kind of cause your mast cells to kind of go into this hyperactive state where these mast cells are just degranulating their mediators, which there's tons of, histamine being one of them, and causing these kind of like allergic-like reactions, like the rashes that I'm having, the breathlessness, things along those lines. So it's really interesting. It's also really interesting because I do have I will go into anaphylaxis with certain foods. So I have this kind of already, you know, even though I'm metabolically healthy in all these ways, I do have a severe allergy to walnuts. So could it be that I already have mast cells that are potentially prone to being hyperactive and shooting out a ton of histamine? Who knows? So that's a really interesting theory that, you know, has led me to go on an antihistamine diet, which actually has been quite helpful. In addition to that, there's of course this new theory around microclots. I think a lot of researchers actually since early 2020 have argued that COVID-19 is not only a lung disease, but it's actually something that significantly affects vascular and coagulation blood clotting systems. So, you know, blood clots, of course, can really limit things like gas exchange, causing breathlessness and things along those lines. And while this information and research is really exciting, these researchers actually found various inflammatory molecules sort of trapped inside persistent microclots. The bummer about this and mast cell activation is there's no real like pathology kind of test unless you have like a really fancy microscope with a group of researchers that you know. Like there's not really a way to kind of take a look at this. And on things like a pulmonary CT, microclots aren't going to come back. So that could be another really interesting theory. Of course, then there's the continued reservoir of the virus itself, whether that be actual live virus in tissues that's kind of hiding out or viral fragments that are sort of held onto by monocytes or white blood cells that kind of continuously kind of stoke the immune system. That's another theory. Of course, organ damage in and of itself caused by a potential sort of this hypo or hyper inflammatory environment. So these are some of the things that have become very interesting to me that I think show a lot of promise, but there's so much work to be done. And in the interim, you know, of course, all these poor long COVID sufferers, other sufferers, I mean, honestly, I feel lucky because there's some people who are completely bedbound. I'm a part of some of these support groups online, and some of what I'm reading about is just devastating. I mean, marriages are ending and, you know, people can't get out of bed. They can't take care of their kids anymore. I mean, I feel very lucky that I'm able to, you know, I have a job where I'm mostly, you know, at a computer and things like that. Granted, I haven't been able to get back to my normal life, but I am able to do things. I'm sitting here talking to you. I can at least plan my fatigue and, or plan around my fatigue and things like that. Right. Some people don't have that luxury. So, but yeah, it's interesting to kind of see where this is headed. I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done. And in the meantime, it's been interesting to see the community of long COVID sufferers really come together and share what's working. We, of course, as much like what we do at MHS, science has to be there. We have to follow the evidence. But in this kind of a situation, it's been really eye-opening to me that long COVID sufferers can't wait, you know, 5-10 years until this information comes out. And it's kind of come down to this network of patients who are sharing information and really progressive physicians who are stepping up to the plate, who are leading some of this research, physicians, academics, you know, you name it, that are leading the charge with this, like the papers that you're reading, that these, you know, the long COVID sufferers are really starting to, are feeling very thankful for. But it's a scary time when you're dealing with something that's completely novel and unknown. Those are some of the theories. Like I said, you know, there definitely needs to be more research, but it's exciting to see where it's headed. And I think lifestyle, 1000%, is one of the most impactful things in helping deal with the long COVID symptoms. And even though it's not completely reversed it for me yet, I do feel really confident that we're headed in the right direction.
Have some of the people in these groups been doing fasting or metabolic therapies as well? Do you feel like that's like an area that really could be helpful?
Yeah, actually, there's specific groups. One in particular that comes to mind that I joined. It's interesting. I started to do prolonged fasts before I found this group. And then I happened to stumble across this like long COVID prolonged fasting group on Facebook. It was so random.
There is literally a group for everything.
There's a group for everything. You can find a lot of
garden on Tuesday.
Totally. And there is a group of people that are doing prolonged fasting. And some of them have had great success. Some I want to mention are, you know, triggered. It's that like kind of hormetic balance, right? You've got to kind of figure out what works for you. And some people, unfortunately, you know, will respond in the group where it's been a little bit too much, like, because you've got to, you know, with long COVID, I mean, there's so many different theories of going on that sort of what's going on. With my recent blood work, we think there's sort of this vascular inflammation and immune dysregulation, potentially. We don't know for sure. But I think for a lot of people, depending on how severe that is, and some people are also dealing with things like POTS and all kinds of stuff, but depending on how severe that is, you know, adding in fasting, while has many benefits, along with like things like cold therapy and whatnot, is also a stressor, right? So there's a really fine balance for anybody who's listening to this that might be suffering from long COVID. Just be very careful. Work with your doctor, of course. Hopefully you have one that's open to maybe monitoring you during this. But some people kind of teeter over that edge where it actually sparks a flare up for some. But it's been really interesting to read. I mean, not that there's like any relation in terms of like the actual condition, but if you think back to just in terms of AIDS, HIV and whatnot, and when that kind of came out of left field, you kind of had a similar sort of situation where people didn't really know how to handle this. And you had this really big patient population that was just grasping for information. So I think there's some really great long COVID groups out there that are doing good evidence-based work and kind of bringing that to the forefront. Survivor Corp is one of those groups. There's an incredible amount of funding that's now going into long COVID research, which is really, really exciting because it's desperately needed. Actually, at Metabolic Health Summit, we're going to be showcasing some of the latest research around metabolic health and COVID-19, both from a severe infection standpoint all the way through to chronic long COVID. I think we've really got to continue. And that's why I'm thankful for you chatting with me about it, because I think it needs to be talked about more. I mean, if you can imagine how many people at this point have been infected, even if it was 10% of those people, that's a lot of people dealing with this chronic condition. I mean, if you're looking at 30, 40%, that's a lot of the population that is, that can be suffering from symptoms long-term, that I think this could be another sort of public health crisis. I know at least there's a lot of people looking for help and answers, and that's why you're seeing all these clinics pop up. So we got a lot of work to do, but hopefully we'll have more information come MHS 2022 that we can share. And of course, all the lifestyle interventions you can imagine that are science-backed, we'll be talking about.
Amazing. Yeah, you guys can follow on my social media. I'll share all the tidbits I can at MHS from all these amazing thought leaders. And Victoria, thank you, because I know this is a level of vulnerability to talk about this publicly and share, but I know you're doing it out of the heart of helping other people who are in your position. So thank you for doing that.
I really appreciate you saying that. It's definitely not easy to talk about, for sure, especially considering like my line of work, but I think that almost makes it more important for me to share information around what I've kind of been through and where lifestyle and science kind of fit into the mix. And we're still figuring it out, but opportunities like this, I think, to share another perspective, to hopefully your listeners are all open-minded. And I know there's a lot of like feelings and stuff around COVID-19 right now, but just taking this as one experience to kind of keeping the back of your mind, I think hopefully if it helps one person, I'm all for it. So I really appreciate everything that you're doing too, in terms of spreading metabolic health information and furthering this movement. So thank you. Oh,
it's not popular to live in the margin all the time. So, So thank you for being a pioneer, and thank you so much for your time. Hey, if you guys want more information about Metabolic Health Summit, you're interested in coming in here and some of these speakers, Victoria shared a discount code for everybody, SEEMAN, that's SEEMAN. You can go to metabolichealthsummit.com. I'll be in Santa Barbara. I don't know. You might find me on the beach one of the days.
For sure. Same. I will be there too.
Mother's Day. We have oceans in Nebraska. Okay.
Right. Mother's Day is Sunday as well. So we're going to be doing some things in honor of that. And you're a super mom. So you better be on the beach on Sunday.
Amazing. Well, I'm not coming home until Monday. So my kids are gonna have to FaceTime me their Mother's Day wishes.
There you go. I love it.
All right, Victoria, thanks for your time. Everybody, thanks. Thank you. Go download this episode, share it with anybody you think it would be helpful. Have a great day.
You too.